Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, historian of pop culture Travis Elborough talks about a book, London Bridge in America, and a film, How We Used to Live. Travis Elborough has been a freelance writer, author and cultural commentator for more than a decade now. His books include The Bus We Loved, A History of the Routemaster Bus, The Long Player Goodbye, A Hymn to Vinyl Records, and Wish You Were Here, A Survey of the British Beside the Seaside. His latest book is London Bridge in America, The Tall Story of a Transatlantic Crossing. He's also recently been the co-writer with Bob Stanley of How We Used to Live, a BFI archive film directed by Paul Kelly, which premiered at the 2013 London Film Festival. And we're going to talk about both the latest book and the film today. So, Travis, first of all, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Pleasure.
My copy of London Bridge in America has a quote from The Guardian, one of Britain's finest pop cultural historians, it says. And I've read the review that came from, and he sort of means it as a bit of a backhanded compliment, really. What do you think you do?
The backhanded compliment, I think, comes from the idea that that accolade isn't really worth having.
Like the world's tallest dwarf.
Yes, exactly. I don't really know. I mean, I suppose roughly what I do is in the field of cultural history. I'm often interested in how things are described in novels and films and imagery as much as the historical fact. So often I'll use digressions about film or music in order to talk about a historical thing and vice versa. I think that's... I mean, I tend to refer to them as wayward social histories, but that's probably a bit pretentious, isn't it? I mean, they're not... You know, they're serious, but they're also hopefully entertaining and conversational. I mean, I think, like most people writing books, you want to write a book for some sort of imaginary audience that you believe is almost like yourself. I mean, it began with my first book, which is a book about the London Routemaster Bus, as you mentioned. And I think at that time, when I was doing research into that, all the books I were reading about Routemaster Buses were written by enthusiasts for enthusiasts. It was a very closed, kind of small world. And it didn't seem to describe this vehicle, which I was, you know, experiencing in London, both as a kind of a living part of the city, as a piece of transport, but also how much it appeared in, you know, in films and on record sleeves and on postcards. So that was the starting point, in a way, for a way of tackling those kind of topics, I guess.
Why do you think that sort of thing is worthy of our attention? You know, why should something that you would expect to be of interest to enthusiasts be sort of palatable to a wider audience?
I think in that case it was more that lots of people seem to like this thing, but the only thing written about seemed to be, I mean, that particular book, I think I described it along the lines of like having a wedding photographer who turned up at the wedding and obsessively took photographs of the cake and wasn't interested in any of the other stuff. That was my, it was more, I suppose, the humanity of it, in a way, that, you know, that how we interact with it was what was seemed missing. It was all very well to talk about the engine numbers and, you know, the types of crankshafts and God knows what else, but it somehow seemed to miss the more humdrum but also magical element of something within the city. And I suppose that's similar, or at least connected to the idea of, you know, London Bridge, this chunk of granite, which in London performs a fairly, you know, mundane task, but a vital one of, you know, conveying people across from one side of the river to the other, then gets taken up and sold to the States, where it becomes almost like an ornament and an amusement element ferment, mm-hmm. the starter yeast of a whole new leisure complex. And I think that's an interesting thing that's happened in recent history anyway, that we're quite used to the idea of power stations suddenly being turned into museums or art galleries and, you know, chocolate factories becoming theatres, sort of a post-industrial use of those buildings where they find a kind of new life.
Where did you first come across this story then? When did you first realise that you wanted to tell this story of London Bridge?
The first time I heard this story, as far as it, the story that, you know, London Bridge had been sold to the States, was as a small child. It, you know, I grew up on the South Coast. But I have very vivid memories of a particular teacher called Mrs. Sargent, who would always kind of whip her acoustic guitar out and strum us some songs at any opportunity, seemingly. And this in the kind of, you know, learn by play middle 70s. But anyway, teaching us, you know, the London Bridge is falling down rhyme, and then pausing and saying, but the real London Bridge is in America. And at that time, she might as well have said, you know, the moon. It seems so sort of exotic and other, you know, America. You know, I'd seen London on, you know, on motorway signs, but, I, you know, America was only kind of beamed into us by a television and, you know, who had landed on the moon but the Americans. And most of the aliens you met, with a couple of notable exceptions, on TV, you know, had American accents. So that's when I first ever heard of the story. I was reacquainted again, actually, with the bus book, because there was always a story that beneath this London Bridge in, you know, in Arizona, there was supposedly a Routemaster bus serving as like an ice cream parlour at the foot of it. And I went on a radio show for Five Live, which went out at an incredibly early hour of the morning, and they rang up Lake Havasu City, where London Bridge is, and we all had a chat about their bus, and they said, oh, you know, you should come over and see it. So rather an elongated way that eventually that's what I did do. I mean, the book is a lot about the history of London Bridge. You know, it's 2,000 years of London Bridge. There's a lot of London Bridge in London, to be honest, and, you know, and only really about half of it is about London Bridge in America. But I mean, a period I'm quite fascinated with is the post-war era, and something about that whole swinging London phenomena, which exemplifies Britain both as a modern country, but also to a certain extent trading on lots of arcane bits of history. Lots of there's never more kind of beef eaters in a kind of swinging London film, or red buses kind of whizzing past. I think it's sort of David Mellor, the art historian, wrote a fantastic book about the 60s art scene in London, describes this whole thing of, you know, London speeding up and becoming a much more kinetic city, and part of that is also, you know, these blurry buses. So interested in that idea of London at a point of change, and there's something about the sale of this bridge. The bridge is dumped effectively because it's deemed no longer capable of coping with the increased traffic on the roads. And this is the era when you know, the Eastern Arch is demolished, and, you know, the Westway is about to be constructed, and there are plans to construct what was called, you know, sort of the motorway grid system around London, which would have meant bulldozing half of Greenwich and you know, putting a three-lane motorway through Covent Garden. And there's this odd contradiction in the way that the Americans buy for their new city this chunk of old granite, which is deemed, you know, surplus for requirement and out of date in London. So it being, you know, changed from a working bridge into almost a plaything, although it does work as a bridge. But
there's also, well, there's just layers and layers of stories there, because, you know, you've just described your, and I don't want to have a go at your poor teacher, but, you know, her describing singing London Bridge is falling down and then saying, oh, well, actually London Bridge is in America. Well, of course, London Bridge is there over the Thames now. There is a London Bridge.
Yeah.
And the bridge that she was talking about being in America is not the one that, presumably, the nursery rhyme London Bridge is written about.
Yeah.
So there's that. But also, okay, we had to get in that, you know, the fact that everybody that knows this story vaguely in the back of their mind about London Bridge being sold to America will know this story that, of course, they bought the wrong bridge.
Yeah. Yeah, the great story, in effect. I mean, you allude to that whole thing about the story of the bridge. I mean, the person who proposed selling it was a former city journalist, press officer and City of London politician, a guy called Ivan Luckin, who'd been at school with Dennis Thatcher. And he is the guy who comes up with this idea of selling the bridge. And what he sells to the Americans, and he creates a really nice little pamphlet to promote this, is not the selling of bits of John Rennie's 1831 bridge half of the stone of which actually was replaced in the early 19th century, anyway, the early 20th century. He sells it as, you know, 2,000 years of history, you know, takes it right back to the Romans. So, that, you know, the selling itself comes with a whole load of baloney, for want of a better word. It comes with this mythology about the bridge. And, yeah, as you say, that then the most famous thing, certainly the thing I was very aware of and part of the interest and what piqued my interest in trying to do the book was, you know, was the famous story that the Americans had bought the wrong bridge, and what they really wanted was the more decorative, shall we say, Tower Bridge.
And, of course, there's no truth in that story whatsoever.
Well, that would spoil the book for the reader. There is, you can find some doubt in that story. You know, there's a little bit of give. I argue in the book, and I think I've, you know, unearthed enough information that it's extremely unlikely, shall we say, that they bought the wrong bridge. But I mean, also the people that bought the bridge were extraordinary characters. I mean, Luckin himself, you know, the city politician was an extraordinary character, larger than life character anyway. But the people he sold it to also, which was Robert Paxton McCulloch, who is a chainsaw magnate, an oil baron, and a kind of property developer. Going back to the chainsaw, he effectively invents the first, you know, one-person-operated chainsaw. And his partner in crime is a man called Cornelius Vandervelt Wood Jr., who is a championship laureate twirler. He's a championship chili chef. And he also had a hand in the creation of Walt Disney's Disneyland. Mm-hmm. And he's actually a theme park designer when McCulloch and Wood meet one another. And they've got this new town, effectively, that they're building out in the Arizona desert, in a place called Lake Havasu City. There is no Lake Havasu until 1948, when the Parker Dam creates it. I mean, anyone's familiar with, you know, Chinatown, that film with a great story about the kind of water being diverted towards Los Angeles. That it's that Parker Dam, you know, that part of the American history which creates the lake for Lake Havasu. And then Lake Havasu City is, you know, is established by McCulloch and Wood in, you know, 1962-63. So it's a brand new place. And they have an idea to create this settlement which will be home to one of McCulloch's factories building outboard motors and testing outboard motors. And it'll have, you know, fishing and hunting and leisure pursuits as well. And that's the idea. And this is the era when, you know, Las Vegas, for instance, is incredibly popular, and, you know, and it seems to represent the future. You have the suburban flight as well from inner cities, you know. And there's this whole strand of the people I interviewed over there, some of the earlier settlers there, describe themselves as pioneers. They thought of themselves as going to this, beginning this new thing. But the city's doing okay, but Wood essentially hears that London Bridge is for sale and decides they should buy it and make it the centrepiece of their new resort.
We'll come back to that story a bit later on, but let's just go back to the bridge itself, or at least the bridges. I want to talk about the historical London bridges. There's been a bridge on that, roughly on, because it's never quite on the same spot.
No, it moves around roughly a little, roughly on the same spot.
Since Roman times.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. I mean, the first stone bridge is created by a priest bridge builder, a guy called Peter de Colchurch, Peter of Colchurch. It was actually the church that Thomas Becket attended as a boy. There's quite a tradition, actually, within the medieval period, post the Crusades, this, you know, this brother of the bridge, to create bridges as acts of devotion. And there's some feeling that this idea of creating these arches over the waters comes partly from Islamic architecture after the Crusades. But in any case, de Colchurch is the man who rustles up enough money, persuades you know, various people to donate cash, and there's and the upkeep of the bridge, you know, people are encouraged to donate for God and the bridge. It's created in around, I mean, it takes over 30 years, and it's, you know, it's created in the 12th century. De Colchurch himself actually dies before it's finished and is buried in a little chapel which is created on the bridge itself. And the chapel itself was also, because it's on London Bridge, you know, it's the main route in and out of the city of London, but it's also the main pilgrimage route to go out to Canterbury. And really, that, you know, it remains the sole river crossing until the early 18th century, when the old Putney/Fulham Bridge is created. And it's really, you know, you already have London Bridge or the boat, you know, the watermen, the sort of black cabs of their day, and that's the only means across the Thames. So it becomes this huge funnel, and it's an irregular bridge of 19 cutwaters and a drawbridge. It's an inhabited bridge. You know, it has these, you know, these houses and shops overhanging it. You know, it looks like, you know, a spiky bracked dragon, you know, protecting its lair. And it's the bridge that the revolting peasants from Essex, you know, and Kent storm. And it's also the bridge where various heads are stuck on sticks, including that, actually, of Thomas More. And the interesting thing about More is that, you know, More writes the book Utopia. And where does he set his Utopia? It's in the Newfound Land. It's America. So there's it seems quite, you know, prophetic in an odd sense that his head should end up there, and then a later incarnation of London Bridge should end up in America.
You mentioned this idea of the bridge building being almost a sort of devotional thing. And it's a... Well, first of all, it's difficult to envisage from this time period when the river's embanked that this was... The whole riverscape was different. You know, it was literally a mud banks on either side, and other rivers would have been coming in. You know, lots of the other covered over rivers would have been coming in. But the point I was trying to get to was this idea that building a bridge over the Thames, well, actually, you know, right up until modern days, it doesn't really necessarily get any easier. It's a difficult thing to do. It's a lot of people lose their
very
lives.
Very much, yeah. I mean, people do lose their lives during the creation of it. I mean, one of the things is that when the Americans recreate London Bridge in the States, they build it over dry land, in the desert, which is a lot easier because, of course, if you're erecting a bridge in particularly at that point in the Thames, you know, with the fierce current, it's hard work. And many people were killed in the creation of the first London Bridge, and indeed the creation of John Rennie's bridge in the late 1820s, which was opened in 1831.
So why was the original, the Ponte Vecchio style bridge replaced? Let's talk about John Rennie and the bridge that he builds. It is the one that eventually goes to America. Why was that bridge replaced?
I mean, it was replaced really because, you know, true to the nursery rhyme, it was falling down. It had been falling down for centuries. I mean, the City of London were chiselers even in those days, and there's a great historian, his name escapes me now, but describes, you know, the narrative of London Bridge is a narrative of repairs. It's just like the City of London, full stop. London is, you know, always patched and put together. It's never entirely redone, or certainly opportunities to redo it have never really been seized. And that was really the case. I mean, what effectively does for you know, de Colechurch's old stone London Bridge is the great last frost fair of the winter of 1813-1814. I mean, the bridge has already been, the houses in a sense on the bridge have been removed. They're removed in about the 1850s, I think. And, you know, it's been tarted up, largely in part because, you know, Waterloo Bridge, the old Waterloo Bridge has been created alongside it. And, you know, there's a flurry of Southwark Bridge, Blackfriars and stuff. So the old bridge is looking a bit tatty by comparison with these new bridges. So, you know, it has a bit of a facelift to begin with. But then the Great Frost Fair of 1813-1814 just does too much damage to the stone, and eventually they have to agree to replace it. I mean, there had been an earlier competition to try and design a new bridge for London. One of the people that enters that is one of the great Scottish engineers, Thomas Telford, and he proposes the creation of an iron bridge, which unfortunately is turned down and isn't built. And there's a rival plan as well, which is almost like Tower Bridge, but in horizontal with two crossings, almost like with drawbridges on them. There's lots of schemes. Over the centuries, various people have plans to create a new London Bridge, but it's only really after that frost fair that finally they agree that they have to replace it. And the design eventually chosen, it's not actually the original winner of the competition, and John Rennie himself was dead by this time as well. And there is some feeling that probably most of it was designed by one of his sons, George Rennie, and it was certainly completed by his other son, Sir John Rennie. He is an engineer who's done lots of surveying on the river in preparation for the competition, and then sort of submits his own design. And it's a, you know, it's a neoclassical, it's a rather elegant bridge. I mean, if you go to Hyde Park and have a look at the bridge over the Serpentine, which was designed by his son George Rennie, it's quite similar in style. But when it's created, you know, it weighs over 140 tons of granite. It's the heaviest thing that's ever been built in London. It's a really monumental creation. It's opened by William IV with great pomp in 1831. But the truth of the matter is, it was effectively almost immediately out of date the moment it opened. I mean, within 5 years of it opening, you get the opening of London Bridge Station to the south, bringing a whole new swathe of commuters into London. You have steamboats on the river. The population of London's just going haywire. And in a way, the creation of Tower Bridge a bit later, you know, finished in the 1890s, is almost taunting the fact that London Bridge can't really cope with the extra levels of traffic. It also sinks slightly, and also within 20 years they're arguing about having to widen the bridge because it can't cope with the amount of traffic. And in the end, by the early sort of Edwardian period, they have to widen the bridge. So it's almost immediately out of date.
But it does, as you mentioned, it takes until the 1960s before they finally decide that it's no longer fit for purpose and needs to be replaced. And then this guy that you've already mentioned, Ivan Lukin, he's at the London Corporation and is basically a PR guy, comes up with this idea, but it meets quite a lot of resistance at first.
Yes, yeah. Idea. I mean, on the British House Estates Committee, it's treated with a great deal of incredulity. This idea, you know, I think the line is something like someone says, you know, who do you think will put, you know, will buy a heap of old stones? And also, you know, how much do you think you will get? And Lukin comes back with a slightly Dr. Evil figure of, you know, £1 million. And he does achieve that in the end. But you know, there's a fair degree of scepticism about anyone buying it. And it, but actually, looking into the archive stuff, it's not entirely certain that there were that many people that took an interest in buying it, or that many other bidders. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of others that I know of, but Wooden and Paxton McCulloch are the two that come up trumps in the end.
I'm Rachel Cook. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So let's talk about the process of basically taking it down, shipping it over, reconstructing it. How did it work?
Well, there was a 17-year-old apprentice called Alan whose job it was initially to number bits of the stone and put them up. The reality is that McCulloch and Wood didn't buy all of London Bridge. They effectively bought the outer cladding of it. This is also part of the reason why it's extremely unlikely they bought the wrong bridge, because you had to effectively create an undercarriage, like a skeleton bridge, which the cladding was then attached to. We've got to know what you're doing with it, really. And it's effectively, you know, blocks of it are taken apart. It's shipped down to Tilbury and then taken out to Long Beach, California, and then driven the rest of the way to Arizona. I mean, one of the telling things about this process is that McCulloch is unhappy with the speed with which this is all happening. And so he employs a Swedish firm who are at the forefront of a new phenomenon, which is containerisation. And this is the period when London docks are being taken down. And in a way, Rennie's bridge, and Rennie himself was responsible for a couple of London's docks as well, is the point where London, when Rennie's bridge is created, it's when London becomes this huge imperial mercantile power. And, you know, the Thames is one of the liveliest ports, and the port, the Port of London is one of the busiest in the globe. And then by the time it goes and it's being sold, those docks, which were so vital to that trade, are being closed down. So there seems something rather poignant and a little sad about that trajectory.
You've talked about the guy that buys it, Robert McCulloch. What happens to him later on? He has a sort of a not particularly noble ending.
He doesn't. Yeah, he dies in very mysterious circumstances. I mean, they create Lake Havasu. They create, you know, the bridge arrives. They open it and all the rest of it, and the city's doing quite well by that point. Certainly it does the trick in a way, you know, it attracts the attention of the world's media, and Lake Havasu, from looking like it might not survive, then it does. But he's also got his finger in lots of other pies, and also is creating other new town complexes in other areas of the States. And some of these seemingly, or certainly some of his agents, were involved in some possibly sharp practice. And he comes under an investigation by the federal government for some of this, and his son comes under investigation by the federal government for this. And he dies of barbiturate and alcohol overdose in slightly murky circumstances. And that's really it. The conundrum of quite... I mean, there are rumours of mafia money, mafia, you know, wanting to... having it's very... It's not that far from Las Vegas, but, you know, it's intruding on there. On their terrain, in a way. And then later on, C.V. Wood and, you know, McCulloch's son are effectively kind of ousted from the company by one of the earliest venture capitalists. And in a way, I mean, one of the nice things or interesting things about McCulloch and Wood is, in a way, that they're almost adventure capitalists. You know, what they're doing doesn't seem to, you know, by contemporary models, doesn't make a lot of business sense. But there's certainly a rather flamboyant, almost kind of gung-ho approach to how they, you know, let's create a new town out there. You know, I've invented a one-person chainsaw. I know the next thing everyone in America will want will be, you know, a gyroplane in their garage, you know, which is this personal helicopter for everyone. You know, all of these kind of madcap schemes, in a way, which McCulloch and Wood create innovate and invent and engender come from a very different form of American entrepreneurialism to the one that will replace them. It's a lot more colourful. I think that's, you know, why they're so appealing. I mean, and you know, when I met some of the pioneers in Lake Havasu, lots of, you know, a great deal of affection and love for what McCulloch had set in place, and spoke warmly about things he'd done, including on one occasion, you know, shipping some or flying some eggs out for you know, for Easter for the children, because the store didn't have some. But you know, that said, you know, there were a journalist who I interviewed. You know, there were enormous levels of flaws in how Lake Havasu was created. And one of the fascinating things, actually, was that one of the original pioneers, a woman, she and her husband were set up a real estate office there very early on. And her take on it was really to say that it was an incredibly male place. You know, they thought about, you know, hunting and fishing and all of these, right? You know, they put a bowling alley in, they'd done all these things. But there was not a huge amount for the women to do. And she said, she maintained that it was quite harsh to begin with as well. You know, it is right in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the desert. Well, it's off, you know, off Route 66, but it's a harsh terrain. And you know, there were quite a few divorces during the kind of early years because people just couldn't really cope with what was, you know, this, where they placed themselves.
And what's it like now? I mean, how does the bridge fit into the infrastructure of the city? What does it look like?
I mean, oddly, the bridge itself actually looks rather nice. I have to say, it looks rather elegant. I mean, it's a neoclassical bridge, and it's over this rather beautiful expanse of, you know, a greeny blue water. It's very bright and, you know, very sunny. And, you know, as it turns to dusk, it does actually look rather Italian. Mm-hmm. That said, one of the other things that was created by the side of the bridge was an English village, part of which actually originally was given as a gift to the City of London. So there was a piece of Lake Havasu belonged to the City of London. What locals referred to as, they were originally given as an acre of dirt, mm-hmm. but they created this English village, which had, you know, a pub, a kind of Trafalgar Square fountain with, you know, fun-sized Landseer lions, which I was told was made in Mexico, a gate, this old gate from some village in Gloucestershire, by all accounts. A telephone box, all of that stuff, you know, Tudor-y houses and shops. All of that was looking, when I went, in a very poor state. It had gone bankrupt and was all closed up and is about to be replaced with luxury riverside condos. So that part of Lake Havasu's history, in a way, the beginning part of it, is about to be removed, you know, eradicated in a way. And that seems a little sad, but it clearly wasn't. It isn't working for American tourists. I mean, one of the fascinating things is I interviewed one of the head of tourism there and asked, you know, what's the most popular thing to visit there? And it's the lake, you know. Mm-hmm. The lake itself is a chief attraction because people go boating, you know, speed boating, they go, you know, waterboarding, they go fishing, all of that stuff. The bridge itself was fairly low down in the attractions. But the bridge is still there, you know, it's still, as I said, it looks rather elegant. In a weird way, freed from London, you know, when you look at old photographs of it, and this is the bridge that T.S. Eliot wrote about in The Wasteland, and interestingly, both T.S. Eliot and McCulloch originally come from St. Louis, which is another kind of river city. But freed from, you know, having to do a job being, you know, something that commuters tramp over, it takes on a different aspect and actually looks, as I said, you know, quite attractive in a way that in London, you know, covered in smoke. And the interesting thing about the bridge as well is, you know, there's still coal dust and graffiti on it from when it was shipped over, extant stuff. Even an American GI scratched his kind of name and date on a particular piece of stonework. The bridge over there is also hollow. As I say, it was the cladding put on this framework. And a man called Jan Cassis, who was originally from Holland, but retired to America and then ended up in Lake Havasu City, is gave myself and two guys from the leading Harley-Davidson magazine of America, called American Iron, with the three people doing the tour on the particular day I went. And he told us it was hollow and that bats live inside it, and it also has lots of utilities. I mean, as I said, it was originally erected on dry land, so they actually, you know, dynamited a part of the lake to create this Bridgewater Canal to flood water through and underneath the bridge.
Just to finish off on the book then, this is a bridge that, you know, was built in a period of time when the Thames was the sort of gateway to a massive, powerful empire. This bridges sold to America in the post-war period, where that's all been dismantled, mainly by America. What does this story tell us about that transfer of power from London over to the New World?
It's almost exemplified by that. I mean, one of the things I write about in the book as well is how much of the whole swinging London phenomena itself is aerated by American money and American American magazine interest. I mean, the famous Time magazine issue. But prior to that, it's actually an American journalist called John Crosby writing for The Telegraph, who coined the whole swinging London phrase. Yeah, I mean, I think there are two things about it. One is that America feels confident enough about itself to entertain the idea that England is amusing, you know, and that the swinging London phenomenon is worthy of interest, to want of a better word. But at the same time, England itself feels quite good about the idea of itself becoming a more modern country with some of the trappings of tradition. And one of the arguments that I make in the book about why the story of the sale of London Bridge seems to come, you know, the idea that the Americans bought the wrong bridge, seems to come into being roundabout by the early 70s, by which point, you know, you move from, you know, the World Cup victory of 1966 to accusations of shoplifting and defeat in Mexico 1970, and then you're into kind of the three-day week, and a certain theory of endism, in a way, enters the British psyche. So the story of getting one over on those, you know, those damn Yanks seems to come to life, shall we say, around about that period. So I think that's certainly a strand of the story. I suppose one of the things I was also thinking about in studying that period and studying this phenomenon now is what famously, you know, Obama removed. There was a bust of Churchill, I think.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
In the Oval Office, and which he had removed. And when I was in Lake Havasu, actually, someone apologised on my behalf for Obama doing this. So it's, you know, again, where is that transatlantic relationship at this point in time? But also, I suppose the more extraordinary phenomena, if we consider, you know, that we're about to invite the Chinese to help build our, you know, our nuclear power stations and everything else, is whether the balance of power has gone somewhere else again now. There's an estimation of, you know, something like 1 million more Chinese tourists will come to London, and whether they'll, in a way, replace the big boom in the post-war period was, you know, in Europe particularly, was American tourists, and, you know, to a bit later on Japanese tourists. But some of that was because obviously people had historical ancestral connections to Europe. Some of it was because they'd fought in the war and wanted to return to places they'd helped liberate. And some of it was just that they had more money and access to cheap air flights. So Tom Wolfe argued, you know, that the idea of the image of the vulgar American tourist really comes about because, you know, suddenly a swathe of the American population who've never had money before have money and can go out and travel and leave America in the way that they'd never previously done.
And interestingly, part of that the influx of money into China and Chinese tourists out, one of the things that's led to is this bizarre recreation of entire towns in China that are replicas of European towns and things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, so there'll be a new London Bridge being shipped. I mean, there's an element about why would you have the original when, you know, when you can just build a replica anyway. And that, I mean, you know, discussions about, you know, building a recreating Crystal Palace or reassembling the Euston Arch. So I think we've, in an odd respect, I think I said it right at the beginning, but this sale, which in the 1960s looks, you know, looks very wacky to lots of people. You know, Luckin himself, the man who proposes selling it, reaches lots of opposition. It's often mocked in papers, in articles from the period. But it's actually at the forefront, in a way, of something we're very familiar with, which is, you know, finding new uses for old industrial buildings when they're no longer doing that. You know, and as I said before, that, you know, power stations can become art galleries or that chocolate factories can become theatres is now fairly standard and not questioned. And it's an extreme example, but I think the idea of taking a functioning bridge and moving it across to the States, where it becomes a centrepiece of a resort town, it seems like a kind of prescient example of that phenomenon.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Travis Elbrow. We've been talking about his book London Bridge in America, and we're going to leave London Bridge behind now. It doesn't leave us behind because it does appear very briefly in the film that we're going to talk about now, which is How We Used to Live. So, Travis, I'll get you to explain what How We Used to Live is. How would you describe it?
It's an impressionistic portrait of post-war London, constructed using all colour BFI archive footage. It was directed by Paul Kelly. He's a filmmaker this is his fourth film in collaboration with members of the band St. Etienne. It's actually their fourth film about London. And it has music by Pete Wiggs of St. Etienne and also Sarah Cracknell of St. Etienne. Bob Stanley of St. Etienne and myself co-wrote the script.
So how did you get involved?
Well, the idea for the film was Paul's. Paul had seen Terence Davis's film of Time in the City, which I don't know if people are familiar with, but it's a personal essay film about Liverpool using mainly archive footage, some new film stuff as well, but created using archive. I mean, it's a very personal film, you know, almost like a memoir film about growing up in Liverpool and what Liverpool means to him now. And it's a really lovely and rather wonderful film. Paul had seen it, and it just, you know, triggered a thought in his mind. This is about 5 years ago, it should be said, about doing a similar thing about London. And the initial plan was to have a much kind of longer film, longer time scale anyway, you know, sort of ranging over the century of London. And initially I was brought on as much as a researcher come historian, the kind of history man, as it were, to dig up interesting stuff about the city that we could then weave into the story along with the archive footage. For various reasons, the film took different turns over the course of time when we were working on it. A few other archive films also appeared in the interim. And so we went back and rejigged our idea and decided to make it, well, Paul, in effect, decided to make it all colour, and therefore it'd be a portrait of post-war London. So, I mean, the footage runs from about 1950 to about 1980. Some of that was to do with the nature of the footage, that after about 1980, people start using video, so there's a distinct falling off in how it looks, or certainly it looks very different from the film stuff, which was created in the 1950s by the government. And this is the whole thing. A lot of this film was made by the British Transport Commission or Central Office of Information and so on. So it was a government-funded thing to create a portrait of Britain and of London through film. And, I mean, that became actually quite an interesting thing in itself because it frames the film, because what you have, in a way, is that the film begins at the end of the war with the creation of the welfare state, and then at the end you end up with the spectre of Thatcherism and the Falklands War, but also the threat of nuclear war and the unravelling, in a way, of the post-war settlement. So that became, in a way, the framing point. But I think we all felt, in a way, that London's history, you know, which is fascinating and has been told many times on film and in books, it's not the case that it was too familiar, because there's still, you know, fascinating bits you can unearth. It was more that we wanted something that wasn't quite linear, that didn't just sort of trundle its way through the decades. So Paul began kind of assembling the footage in, often by themes. Yeah, there'd mm-hmm. be sort of transport themes, there'd be themes about children, there'd be themes about the river, and so on. And then Bob and I would get together and, you know, we're taking some of those themes, and we had themes ourselves that we wanted to cover and talk about, and we would write this script. And the script is narrated. It's a narrator script, in a way, rather like Patrick Keeler's London, which we're all huge fans of. So McShane is the voice of the film. And in a way, he's the voice of memory. He's often forgetful. He goes to the pub a few times in the film, or his voice character does anyway. Certainly part of the pub footage. And another starting point for the character was actually Keith Waterhouse's Billy Liar, but the premise being, and it was really only a starting premise, was, you know, what would it have been like if Billy Liar had stayed on the train and come down to London and was now, some 50 years later, you know, reflecting on his life in the city. So that was a device. It's not really what the character is, but these were all ways of getting the voice of the character. And the narrator, you know, it has, you know, lots of historical names of nursery rhymes, defunct telephone exchanges. I mean, the whole thing about those telephone exchanges is that they often had a historical element to them. So it's another way of creating these little layers within the film.
I want to come back to the actual writing process in a moment, but you've already talked about this idea of the distinct time period. And this is made very explicit at the end of the film, at the beginning of the credits. It says almost everything you've been watching has been made with funding from the British government between 1950 and 1980. Now, the 1980 point, you know, the latest stuff in the film is the beginnings of the building of Canary Wharf. And we've talked about, you know, this point of the beginnings of Thatcherism really getting underway. But more prosaically, does this type of government-funded filmmaking just stop at that point? I mean, is that done away with?
Yeah, actually it is, yeah. it is done away with. So it's even more striking, in a way, that, you know, the demise of the film stock we were using comes about precisely because of Thatcherism. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those things are wound up and that ends. I mean, we should be clear that, in a way, that it's not... I mean, the film hopefully celebrates, you know, both, you know, the thriving youth culture of that time, but also, you know, the municipal and the civic city. That said, a lot of that footage is of the, you know, come to London, it's wonderful, rather unquestioning. So part of the thing that we did, and part of the thing that Paul did particularly, which was to use sounds and narrations from other archive films and move it over things to create certain impishness.
Yes.
I mean,
the Queen driving the
tube. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean you know, well, we spent several months in this little room in the BFI's headquarters on Stephen Street, viewing old footage. And this, one of the things about colour, using colour, is that it was expensive, so it tends to be used for the big occasions. So you have endless stuff of, you know, Piccadilly Circus, you know, the Queen, the trooping of the colour, etc. So we were trying to subvert that to a certain extent, or at least be playful with it. So that was kind of one of the ambitions, was to, you know, use that material in as entertaining and as you know, the idea is just to provoke thought, to think about what that pomp and circumstance means now as much as it did then.
You've talked about possibly a sort of overarching the Billy Liar thing as a framework, but also Paul's collecting different themed parts of the archive footage. But I wanted to ask whether, you know, how does the writing of a script for an archive film work? Did you have a sort of overarching story in mind that you would then find the footage for, or is it all dictated by the footage that you find?
I mean, it was largely footage-driven. There were lots of stuff that Bob and I wrote which didn't find it into the film because there just wasn't the footage to go with it. I mean, Bob has a particular fondness and affection for the great cafe era of the 50s and 60s, you know, these great, you know, Formica-tabled, frothy coffee-vending dens, which are, you know, such a hive of youth activity, you know, skiffle and pop culture and fashion. And there is, I think there's one or two films, some which are slightly over-familiar now. They've been shown quite a lot of that stuff, but very little, really. So, you know, we had lots of stuff about that, which didn't make it in there. And actually, even within the material that we had, that we did have footage for, Paul also honed the script down kind of even further. We spent a couple of Sunday afternoons putting the, once we'd recorded the narration, we recorded Ian was actually, Ian McShane was in, he'd agreed to do it, was in Hungary. So he had to do it kind of down the line. So we went to the studio in Oxford and then had him recorded there. And he was amazing, actually, and did a really fantastic job. And one of the great things about it, or the flattering things to Bob and myself's script, is there are, I mean, one of the reasons we chose Ian, in a way, was because he, grown up in Blackburn, his father played for Manchester United, and he'd come down to London in, you know, in the early 60s to attend RADA, and in a way had lived through that mm-hmm. period, and is in a couple of, you know, fantastic 60s and early 70s films about London, you know, Pleasure Girls, where he plays a kind of happening photographer, mm-hmm. and then later a kind of nicely dark gangster film called Villain, mm-hmm. Where he's playing practically kind of Richard Burton's boyfriend, and Richard Burton is a kind of composite Cray twin. He's of that age, mm-hmm. and he, you know, you could imagine him having gone through that, you know, that experiences. But there are bits in the script. There's a line about.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.